Chapter 4. The decisive action. But Kate sprang before her. "No, no, don't ask him. I implore you not to ask him," she cried. Mrs. Peyton turned on her with sudden authority of voice and gesture. "Do I understand you?" she said. "You admit that you have a reason for putting off your marriage, and yet you forbid me, Dennis's mother, to ask him what it is? My poor child, I needn't ask, for I know already. If he has offended you, and you refuse him the chance to defend himself, I needn't look farther for your reason. It is simply that you have ceased to love him." Kate fell back from the door which she had instinctively barricaded. "Perhaps that is it," she murmured, letting Mrs. Peyton pass. Mr. Orme's returning carriage wheels crossed Mrs. Peyton's indignant flight, and an hour later Kate, in the bland candlelight of the dinner hour, sat listening with practiced fortitude to her father's comments on the venison. As he had wondered, as she awaited him in the drawing room, if he would notice any change in her appearance. It seemed to her that the flagellation of her thoughts must have left visible traces. But Mr. Orme was not a man of subtle perceptions, save where his personal comfort was affected. Though his egoism was clothed in the finest feelers, he did not suspect a similar surface in others. His daughter, as part of himself, came within the normal range of his solicitude. But she was an outlying region, a subject province, and Mr. Orme's was a highly centralized polity. News of the painful incident he often used Mrs. Peyton's vocabulary had reached him at his club, and to some extent, disturbed the assimilation of a carefully ordered breakfast. But since then 2 days had passed, and it did not take Mr. Orme 48 hours to resign himself to the misfortunes of others. It was all very nasty, of course, and he wished to heaven it hadn't happened to anyone about to be connected with him, but he viewed it with the transient annoyance of a gentleman who has been splashed by the mud of a fatal runaway. Mr. Orme affected, under such circumstances, a bluff and hearty stoicism as remote as possible from Mrs. Peyton's deprecating evasion of facts. It was a bad business. He was sorry Kate should have been mixed up with it. But she would be married soon now, and then she would see that life wasn't exactly a Sunday school story. Everybody was exposed to such disagreeable accidents. He remembered a case in their own family, a distant cousin whom Kate wouldn't have heard of, a poor fellow who had gotten tangled with just such a woman, and having, most properly, been sent packing by his father, had justified the latter's course by promptly forging his name, a very nasty affair altogether. But luckily the scandal had been hushed up, the woman bought off, and the prodigal, after a season of probation, safely married to a nice girl with a good income, who was told by the family that the doctors recommended his settling in California. Luckily the scandal was hushed up, the phrase blazed out against the dark background of Kate's misery. That was doubtless what most people felt. The words represented the consensus of respectable opinion. The best way of repairing a fault was to hide it. To tear up the floor and bury the victim at night. Above all, no coroner and no autopsy. She began to feel a strange interest in her distant cousin. And his wife, did she know what he had done? Mr. Orme stared. His moral pointed, he had returned to the contemplation of his own affairs. His wife? Oh, of course not. The secret has been most admirably kept, but her property was put in trust, so she's quite safe with him. Her property? Kate wondered if her faith in her husband had also been put in trust, if her sensibilities had been protected from his possible inroads. Do you think it quite fair to have deceived her in that way? Mr. Orme gave her a puzzled glance. He had no taste for the bypaths of ethical conjecture. His people wanted to give the poor fellow another chance. They did the best they could for him. And he has done nothing dishonorable since? Not that I know of. The last I heard was that they had a little boy, and that he was quite happy. At that distance he's not likely to bother us, at all events. Long after Mr. Orme had left the topic, Kate remained lost in its contemplation. As he had begun to perceive that the fair surface of life was honeycombed by a vast system of moral sewage. Every respectable household had its special arrangements for the private disposal of family scandals. It was only among the reckless and improvident that such hygienic precautions were neglected. Who was she to pass judgment on the merits of such a system? The social health must be preserved. The means devised were the result of long experience and the collective instinct of self-preservation. As he had meant to tell her father that evening that her marriage had been put off, but she now abstained from doing so, not from any doubt of Mr. Orme's acquiescence. He could always be made to feel the force of conventional scruples, but because the whole question sank into insignificance beside the larger issue which his words had raised. In her own room, that night, she passed through that travail of the soul, of which the deeper life is born. Her first sense was of a great moral loneliness and isolation more complete, more impenetrable, than that in which the discovery of Dennis's act had plunged her. For as he had vaguely leaned, then, on a collective sense of justice that should respond to her own ideas of right and wrong, she still believed in the logical correspondence of theory and practice. Now she saw that, among those nearest her, there was no one who recognized the moral need of expiation. She saw that to take her father, or Mrs. Peyton, into her confidence would be but to widen the circle of sterile misery in which she and Dennis moved. At first the aspect of life thus revealed to her seemed simply mean and base, a world where honor was a pact of silence between adroit accomplices. The network of circumstance had tightened round her, and every effort to escape drew its meshes closer. But as her struggles subsided, she felt the spiritual release which comes with acceptance. Not connivance in dishonor, but recognition of evil. Out of that dark vision light was to come, the shaft of cloud turning to the pillar of fire. For here, at last, life lay before her as it was. Not brave, garlanded and victorious, but naked, groveling and diseased, dragging its maimed limbs through the mud, yet lifting piteous hands to the stars. Love itself, once throned aloft on an altar of dreams, how it stole to her now, storm-beaten and scarred, pleading for the shelter of her breast. Love, indeed, not in the old sense in which as he had conceived it, but a graver, austere presence, the charity of the mystic three. She thought as he had ceased to love Dennis, but what had she loved in him but her happiness and his? Their affection had been the garden enclosed of the canticles, where they were to walk forever in a delicate isolation of bliss. But now love appeared to her as something more than this, something wider, deeper, more enduring than the selfish passion of a man and a woman. She saw it in all its far-reaching issues, till the first meeting of two pairs of young eyes kindled a light which might be a high-lifted beacon across dark waters of humanity. All this did not come to her clearly, consecutively, but in a series of blurred and shifting images. Marriage had meant to her, as it means to girls brought up in ignorance of life, simply the exquisite prolongation of wooing. If as he had looked beyond, to the vision of whiter ties, it was as a traveler gazes over a land veiled in golden haze, and so far distant, that the imagination delays to explore it. But now through the blur of sensations one image strangely persisted, the image of Dennis's child. Had she ever before thought of their having a child? She could not remember. She was like one who wakens from a long fever. She recalled nothing of her former self, or of her former feelings. She knew only that the vision persisted, the vision of the child whose mother she was not to be. It was impossible that she should marry Dennis. Her inmost soul rejected him. But it was just because she was not to be the child's mother that its image followed her so pleadingly. For she saw with perfect clearness the inevitable course of events. Dennis would marry someone else. He was one of the men who are fated to marry, and she needed not his mother's reminder that her abandonment of him at an emotional crisis would fling him upon the first sympathy within reach. He would marry a girl who knew nothing of his secret, for Kate was intensely aware that he would never again willingly confess himself. He would marry a girl who trusted him and leaned on him, as she, Kate Orme, a year earlier Kate Orme had done, but 2 days since. And with this deception between them, their child would be born. Born to an inheritance of secret weakness, a vice of the moral fiber, as it might be born with some hidden physical taint which would destroy it before the cause should be detected. Well, and what of it? Was she to hold herself responsible? Were not thousands of children born with some such unsuspected taint? Ah, but if here was one that she could save? What if she, who had had so exquisite a vision of wifehood, should reconstruct from its ruins this vision of protecting maternity, if her love for her lover should be, not lost, but transformed, enlarged, into this passion of charity for his race? If she might expiate, and redeem his fault, by becoming a refuge from its consequences? Before this strange extension of her love, all the old limitations seemed to fall. Something had cleft the surface of self, and there welled up the mysterious primal influences, the sacrificial instinct of her sex, a passion of spiritual motherhood, that made her long to fling herself between the unborn child and its fate. She never knew, then or after, how she reached this mystic climax of effacement. She was only conscious, through her anguish, of that lift of the heart which made one of the saints declare that joy was the inmost core of sorrow. For it was indeed a kind of joy she felt, if old names must serve for such new meanings. A surge of liberating faith in life, the old credo quia absurdum, which is the secret cry of all supreme endeavor. Part 2. Does it look nice, Mother? Dick Peyton met her with the question on the threshold, drawing her gaily into the little square room, and adding, with a laugh with a blush in it, "You know she's an uncommonly noticing person, and little things tell with her." He swung round on his heel, to follow his mother's smiling inspection of the apartment. "She seems to have all the qualities," Mrs. Dennis Peyton remarked, as her circuit finally brought her to the prettily appointed tea table. "All," he declared, taking the sting from her emphasis by his prompt adoption of it. Dick had always had a wholesome way of thus appropriating to his own use such small shafts of maternal irony as were now, and then aimed at him. Kate Peyton laughed, and loosened her furs. "It looks charmingly," she pronounced, ending her survey by an approach to the window, which gave, far below, the oblique perspective of a long side street leading to Fifth Avenue. The high-perched room was Dick Peyton's private office, a retreat partitioned off from the larger enclosure in which, under a north light, and on a range of deal tables, three or four young draftsmen were busily engaged in elaborating his architectural projects. The outer door of the office bore the sign, "Peyton and Gill, Architects." But Gill was an utilitarian person, as unobtrusive as his name, who contented himself with a desk in the workroom, and left Dick to lord it alone in the small apartment to which clients were introduced, and where the social part of the business was carried on. It was to serve, on this occasion, as the scene of a tea designed, as Kate Peyton was vividly aware, to introduce a certain young lady to the scene of her son's labors. Mrs. Peyton had been hearing a great deal lately about Clemens Verney. Dick was naturally expansive, and his close intimacy with his mother, an intimacy fostered by his father's early death, if it had suffered some natural impairment in his school and college days, had of late been revived by 4 years of comradeship in Paris, where Mrs. Peyton, in a tiny apartment of the Rue de Varennes, had kept house for him during his course of studies at the Beaux-Arts. There were indeed not lacking critics of her own sex who accused Kate Peyton of having figured too largely in her son's life, of having failed to efface herself at a period when it is agreed that young men are best left free to try conclusions with the world. Mrs. Peyton, had she cared to defend herself, might have said that Dick, if communicative, was not impressionable, and that the closeness of texture which enabled him to throw off her sarcasms preserved him also from the infiltration of her prejudices. He was certainly no knight of the apron string, but a seemingly resolute and self-sufficient young man, whose romantic friendship with his mother had merely served to throw a veil of suavity over the hard angles of youth. But Mrs. Peyton's real excuse was after all one which she would never have given. It was because her intimacy with her son was the one need of her life, that as he had, with infinite tact and discretion, but with equal persistency, clung to every step of his growth, dissembling herself, adapting herself, rejuvenating herself in the passionate effort to be always within reach, but never in the way. Dennis Peyton had died after 7 years of marriage, when his boy was barely six. During those 7 years he had managed to squander the best part of the fortune he had inherited from his stepbrother, so that, at his death, his widow and son were left with a scant competence. Mrs. Peyton, during her husband's life, had apparently made no effort to restrain his expenditure. As he had even been accused by those judicious persons who are always ready with an estimate of their neighbor's motives, of having encouraged poor Dennis's improvidence for the gratification of her own ambition. As he had in fact, in the early days of their marriage, tried to launch him in politics, and had perhaps drawn somewhat heavily on his funds in the first heat of the contest, but the experiment ending in failure, as Dennis Peyton's experiments were apt to end, as he had made no farther demands on his exchequer. Her personal tastes were in fact unusually simple, but her outspoken indifference to money was not, in the opinion of her critics, designed to act as a check upon her husband, and it resulted in leaving her, at his death, in straits from which it was impossible not to deduce a moral. Her small means, and the care of the boy's education, served the widow as a pretext for secluding herself in a socially remote suburb, where it was inferred that she was expiating, on queer food and in ready-made boots, her rash defiance of fortune. Whether or not Mrs. Peyton's penance took this form, she hoarded her substance to such good purpose that she was not only able to give Dick the best of schooling, but to propose, on his leaving Harvard, that he should prolong his studies by another 4 years at the Beaux-Arts. It had been the joy of her life that her boy had early shown a marked bent for a special line of work. She could not have borne to see him reduced to a mere money-getter, yet she was not sorry that their small means forbade the cultivation of an ornamental leisure. In his college days Dick had troubled her by a superabundance of tastes, a restless flitting from one form of artistic expression to another. Whatever art he enjoyed he wished to practice, and he passed from music to painting, from painting to architecture, with an ease which seemed to his mother to indicate lack of purpose, rather than excess of talent. As he had observed, that these changes were usually due, not to self-criticism, but to some external discouragement. Any depreciation of his work was enough to convince him of the uselessness of pursuing that special form of art, and the reaction produced the immediate conviction that he was really destined to shine in some other line of work. He had thus swung from one calling to another till, at the end of his college career, his mother took the decisive step of transplanting him to the Beaux-Arts, in the hope that a definite course of study, combined with the stimulus of competition, might fix his wavering aptitudes. The result justified her expectation, and their 4 years in the Rue de Varennes yielded the happiest confirmation of her belief in him. Dick's ability was recognized, not only by his mother, but by his professors. He was engrossed in his work, and his first successes developed his capacity for application. His mother's only fear was that praise was still too necessary to him. She was uncertain how long his ambition would sustain him in the face of failure. He gave lavishly where he was sure of a return, but it remained to be seen if he were capable of production without recognition. As he had brought him up in a wholesome scorn of material rewards, and nature seemed, in this direction, to have seconded her training. He was genuinely indifferent to money, and his enjoyment of beauty was of that happy sort which does not generate the wish for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.